wondering if mankind is cursed. He's ruining the sky and the ocean even worse. But I'll predict the cause of his eradication from the earth. Oh, plutonium is forever. Now oil slicks someday will disappear. We'll stop dumping PCBs in a few years. But there is one pollutant that we should really fear. Oh, plutonium is forever. Will it go away? For our purpose is never. It will be here past doomsday. Yes, plutonium is forever. Now carbon monoxide will only steal your breath. Asbestos poisoning give the workers a horrible death.
Well, that's enough things to knock you off your feet. A song from John Hall, who wrote a more well-known song called Power, which was kind of the anthem of the No Nukes gathering that happened a long time ago. That one from John Hall, Plutonium is Forever. Yeah, we're going to be talking nukes here on Green Zine with Chris and Henry. We'll be bringing them up in the mix in just a moment. You are tuned to all Free Vermont Radio. Well, we ask for donations from our listeners and our members and our underwriters, but no commercials here, just a lot of music, a lot of public affairs programming. Glad to have you on board with us. We also want to thank the folks who bring Green Zine to you each week, and they include Solaflect. That is the moving solar company. Yeah, they do a little tracking out there. Not much gain going on today, fortunately, because rain has returned to our area. Also, Bale. Want to congratulate Bale for getting the Royalton Farmers Market going. They had a really successful season out there every other Sunday. I'm sure they're planning for it next year. Find out more about their activities at balevt.org. Tom Wells, I was in touch with him a little bit earlier, longtime supporter of the radio station. Daniel Leibowitz, our original treasurer, now practicing law down in the swamp. I think he lives in Georgetown, right there in D.C. The Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest. I'll give you a little update on them maybe in the latter stages of the show. Wit and Grit and the Yes We Can Collective. So thanks to all those folks. Now I'm going to turn on a couple of microphones. I think Henry might be on Channel 12 today. Good morning, Henry.
Let's see if that is. You're very good.
Well, yeah, the wires get changed. Microphones get changed. I've been told this speaker is actually lower than this one. But right now, we're on the air. Henry Swayze, good to see you again. Live in the studio.
Yes, it's a delight to be here. So, and we have today, we have Chris Williams from the Citizens Awareness Network, which with a pretty heavy focus on let's not have any plutonium.
Indeed, and we'll get to Chris here in just a little bit. And you know, with that acronym CAN, yeah, well, yeah. It's been a long fight, but maybe Yes We Can finally put nuclear power and, of course, nuclear weapons to rest. It's a long struggle. Well, Henry, it was good to hang out with you. Let's do a little retrospective here. We were both over at Sunday in Middlebury. Some interesting presentations and talks over there. What was your takeaway from, you did a lot of networking. In fact, I think some people thought you were part of the committee over there.
Well, they looked as though they had more questioners than they had official smart people to answer the questions. So I stepped in. yes, there were many, many different organizations there, and there were electric vehicles. I was helping out with the Vermont Natural Resources booth because they had solar panels and Porch Solar and what would be coming with that. And so since we had just done a fairly deep dive with that, I felt I could answer good questions. And so just stepped up and said, here, let me help out too.
They even had, I don't know, that sort of connect system, kind of a flat plate that was being used that will be necessary for people to do the balcony solar. And if you're checking in with us for the first time, this is a bill that's going to be introduced, I believe. She's a senator. Ann Watson is leading the charge on this. A bill that will allow ratepayers here in Vermont to basically have a small solar array, might be hanging off a balcony or just kind of on a stand out front with good solar gain, and it will feed back into their system, probably with the help of that unit that I saw. And right. They could knock as much, depending on their electricity use, maybe as much as 20% off their bill without putting in $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for a solar array on a roof or pole mount.
It will be a lovely, low-cost way of entering solar, and the power companies, will have to see as it gets closer to the deadline and the bill's written, but the power companies are quite concerned with having to have extra power pushed back on the grid when they don't have any place to put it. But they are not too disturbed about your reducing your power bill, because they're seeing the demand for electricity going up, and to meet that demand, it requires a lot of infrastructure cost, and so they can avoid that cost and keep their situation leveler by having some additional power being generated. And the system, if you're doing net metering, if you put a big solar operation and try and basically offset your entire power bill, the utility company is. If you're generating, at least I can speak from my own situation, because I've been looking at that with Washington Electric. They basically have a meter that is measuring the power you've generated, and then a meter showing the power that you've taken from the grid. And it, when you get all through with all the different charges and things, it comes out that they're giving you just slightly more than half of the power back that you on a cost basis that you provided. So the balcony solar, all of that solar generation, if you are using it in your house, if there's a circuit in your house that is absorbing that power, refrigerator running, lights, furnace, whatever, it's 100% your electricity with no extra charge goes to that. So that's the concept. And for people who are out of their house all day long, there's nobody there, and you do have a refrigerator or maybe a furnace running in the winter, you're going to get a good deal of that solar absorbed by your own household use. But anything, the utility company won't be taking any of that power back.
That's right. It would just be used. So, it's once again trying to be part of having a smart house, smart meter, that you are saying, right now it's a really sunny day, I'm about to crank up the vacuum cleaner or something. Maybe this is a good time to do it, because your balcony solar panel is out there and a lot of that power will be used there and not coming from the utility. Let me ask you this, Henry. I'm jumping ahead. I was talking solar with our colleague. I think we've been around Amos Post and Integrity Energy, and obviously with other solar companies, Catamount Solar, Solaflect. But he was up at our studio, and we were contemplating for a possible grant that we might receive for emergency preparedness of having backup power provided by solar. But there are a lot of complications up there as far as sight line with the sun, late afternoon, trees in the way, et cetera, cost. He did bring up Green Mountain Power as far as their lease program with Tesla batteries. Mm-hmm. We talked about that. And between the two of us putting on our mathematician's hat, it didn't really seem like it was going to be a good fix. We wouldn't really get enough solar gain to offset most of our usage, even with getting two power walls at $55 a month lease, 10-year lease, you're locked in. We would still be paying outside of that, even with the storage there, some additional bill to them, which would have turned out to actually be more than what we're paying now. So, but let's go back to balcony solar. Maybe if that bill gets passed, radio station might make some sense to have that up there at the...
Yeah, I think you could probably, because we are continually absorbing 700 watts at the transmitter.
That's right, 720, yeah.
720, so that's going out the door, whether we like it or not. That's the cost of having a signal on the air.
Yeah. Yeah, if we could offset that. Okay, we might return to a solar story that's on the front page of the Herald. If you get the Herald, you'll see it there. It involves a new grid tied, in fact, the last probably grid tied solar array to go in our area because of the way the regs have changed, and you can read about it in the Herald. So you are listening to Green Zine, and we're already about 11 minutes into the show. Shall we check out Bird Note, Henry?
Yeah, let's conform somewhat to our normal.
And I've been listening to the crows. You selected one that's got some crows involved.
Yeah, and a little bit of literature developed because of it too.
All right, here we go. We're going to go to Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. Author Kira Jane Buxton loves crows. So much that she's written two novels about a crow named ST, navigating the extinction of humanity. When she was writing those books, she tried befriending the crows in her neighborhood and wound up bonding with a pair of them.
They are a dyad, a paired male and female. I call them T and Dart, and they have honestly become family to me. T in particular, the female, she's incredibly clumsy. She drools when she eats. She's very quirky. She used to love to call for me out the front porch, and then I would come out and she would hide and I'd have to try and find her. And then she'd do a kind of jump scare and pop out at me. That was her favorite thing for a while. And her partner, Dart, is a very handsome crow. He's a little bit more aloof. She'll come right up to me. He will watch and keep an eye out for her. And she will eat all the food and share nothing. And he always shares his food with her. It reminds me a lot of my relationship with my husband. You know, he's gregarious and altruistic, and she just wants to eat all the snacks. It took a long time to garner the trust of these two birds, and now we have this sort of reciprocity of respect.
Many details of her crow-tagonist in her novels, Hollow Kingdom and Feral Creatures, are drawn from T and Dart. You can find links to those books at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
Oh, very good, Henry.
Yes, I was quite surprised to find that one.
I came across a story that might have been in a local paper, actually, about a crow that befriended a, I think it was a border collie. Mm-hmm. A young crow had fallen out of the nest and kind of wobbled over, and the homeowner kind of tried to make a little sort of temporary nest, hoping the mom would come back, but that didn't happen, and the dog went out and sniffed around. And I think they've been kind of hanging out together now. It's a full-grown crow, still wow. living there, and didn't move away. And I didn't know that they partnered with the same partner, like she was saying there, between T and Dart. That was news to me.
Yeah, yeah. I'd heard that before, but I'm not sure if it's always true. Maybe there are some couples that are like that and some that aren't.
Okay. Well,
I'm not sure.
I'm always got music on my mind. I think a future crow thread is going to be on the Elephant Stream. I can think of right off the bat six or seven songs right now about crows. So we'll get to that. Hey, why don't we get to our visit? And well, we don't want to really go nuclear, but we're gonna talk about where we are with nuclear power here in our area and nationally. Why don't you give official intro there?
Yeah.
Henry?
So Chris Williams has been. Working on I don't know, you go all the way back to decommissioning Vermont Yankee, don't you?
I go back a little farther than that.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, that wasn't all that long ago.
I've worked on a lot of different campaigns regarding nuclear power plants, but, you know, it's been since about 1978.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was still already getting to retire in 78. So that's been a long haul, and obviously you have done a really deep dive into the health effects and the kind of collateral damage you get, or problem solving that are left behind when you do nuclear. And there is a push just recently to try and do modular units to bring the price down. So I wonder if you could kind of say what's bringing nuclear back up to the top of the deck and becoming a discussion topic rather than we don't go there anymore.
I guess to address what you just asked, we have to go back at least to the turn of the century, which was the last time that we had what's now called, you know, a nuclear renaissance. 20 years ago, or maybe 25 now, the industry, along with support from the federal government and a lot of state governments, launched what they referred to as a nuclear renaissance to bring back construction of nuclear power plants. They were afforded subsidies, massive subsidies, loan guarantees, prepayment by ratepayers during construction, a concept called construction work in progress, which is very very bad for ratepayers to pay for something that may never get completed.
Get the money up front. There right. you go.
And so what we ended up with after all that push, that renaissance, was two new reactors added at a place called Plant Vogtle in Georgia, and two half-built reactors that were canceled at the Summer Plant in South Carolina.
Wow.
And in South Carolina, in addition to not completing the two power plants, a couple of executives from the utility are serving prison terms for some corrupt behavior.
No, what a surprise.
So I explain that to put it in context, that that was the last nuclear renaissance. Skip ahead to where we are now, 20 years later, 25 years later. They're calling for another nuclear renaissance.
Yes.
Right. And chances are that this nuclear renaissance is not going to get very far. Mm-hmm. They're talking about small modular reactors like they're something that can be produced on a line at a factory. And
right. Pop-up toasters.
Right. And that's not what it is. Small modular reactors at this point in time don't exist other than on paper. They're putting a lot into what they would refer to as research and development, but we're not seeing a whole lot of progress. The idea that you can just mass produce fission reactors and plant them all over the place is downright absurd. Yeah. You had talked about the health and safety issues. Mm-hmm. Those certainly exist, which is why the existing fleet of reactors in this country and around the world, in fact, are all within heavily reinforced containment structures.
Yeah.
They're hoping that someday with these small modular reactors that they won't have to deal with such
right. You
know, such inconveniences as containment, which is, again, absurd. But in the context of where we are today, when the President of the United States is standing up and declaring climate change a hoax and clean, beautiful coal and drill, baby, drill, and it goes on, they're talking about getting rid of aggressive oversight and regulation for nuclear as a positive thing, as
sure.
a way to bring progress, and that's just not the case.
They seem to want to deregulate everything except for clean energy.
Right.
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 It's quite ironic, and of course, you know, if you only had your corporate business person's hat on, where efficiency, streamlining, let's make this project happen really quickly, you don't want those type of oversight and regulations.
Correct.
Yeah. But you are cautiously optimistic that they can't pull this off.
Yes. And it's not just me. Just yesterday, I read quite an extensive article from none other than the Cato Institute, which...
Mm-hmm. I think they're pretty conservative.
I think so. And the article that they published, and it's on their website, basically says this thing isn't going to get off the ground. There's going to be a lot of talk. They're going to spend a lot of money. I'll give them, you know, that they might be able to get some small number off the ground
mm-hmm.
at incredible prices. And I would look to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is a sacrificed community that dates back to the Manhattan Project. They may build a couple, you know, showplace reactors there.
Interesting term you just used, a sacrifice community. Well, I think I know what that means, but can you define that for us?
A community that the industry and or the government together both declared or decided would be the home to part of the weapons and or power complex that is going to be radioactively contaminated forever.
Forever, okay.
And I could go through the list because when they talk about how clean nuclear energy is, and Governor Scott has been pushing for
yes.
changing the renewable energy standard that was just updated last year to the clean energy standard to include nuclear power.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Wow.
And what I have been doing in response to what the administration has been pushing with this bill, and I'm sure it'll come up again in the legislature this year, is to remind people of the fuel cycle that is intermingled with the weapons cycle. And it goes back to the Manhattan Project. And when you look at where we are today, there are contaminated sacrifice communities from coast to coast that you never hear a whole lot about. A lot of them are on native lands where the mines are, enriching uranium in Piketon, Ohio, and Paducah, Kentucky, has resulted in contaminated communities that have incidence of cancer and premature deaths that are significantly high. And I could go on.
Hmm.
You're also dealing with a lot of reactor communities in this country. But those communities, unfortunately, have not had extensive epidemiological studies performed over the lifetime of their operation. And that's deliberate on behalf of the government and the industry. They don't want to know what they don't want to know. Yeah.
So would we know that the nuclear power plant, Vermont Yankee, that operated here for, was it 40 years?
Yeah.
40 years down in Vernon. That is a decommissioned power plant. I don't know about how they're moving the waste. Would that count as a sacrifice community?
Yes.
It would.
In a sense.
So we have our very own.
Not as extensive a sacrifice community as it could have been.
Yeah.
Or could have been. We've been tracking the decommissioning. It's not finished yet.
No.
We're fortunate that the company that's doing it, which isn't by any means perfect, called North Star, has a lot of experience taking large things apart, like skyscrapers and space shuttle launch pads. And they're doing a good job. And for the most part, what they're doing is moving low-level waste out of Vermont to a sacrifice community.
I just going to say,
in Texas, right?
In Andrews County, Texas, where there are quite a few people who are not happy to be receiving low-level waste, not just from Vermont, but from across the country right now.
Yeah. And it's a massive amount of material.
Yes, and they're to the point now where they're the last remaining main structure is the reactor building, and they're taking it down. I was at a meeting of the Vermont Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel just this past Monday, and we saw pictures. There's 45 feet of the reactor building left, and they're grinding it down and shipping it off to Texas.
And does that, we just had the southbound Vermonter go by, is most of that being transported by train or by truck?
Train.
That's what I thought, by train. And we know with some other toxic materials, I'm thinking of a couple places. One was in, I want to say Ohio, but certainly the big train fire that happened up in Canada.
Right.
That if there was a derailment with this, quote, low-level waste in a populated area, not good. It hasn't happened yet, but just
right. And more significantly, and this I didn't get to, what's going to be left at Vermont Yankee, aside from PFAS, other pollutants, and some residual radioactive material, are 58 casks of high level waste, and the high level waste. Again,
has no home except for where it is.
Right. And for anybody to refer to all the spent fuel rods, which are highly radioactive and dangerous, as clean, this is where I would like to ask Governor Scott and his staff to just stop calling it clean. If you want to call it something else, go ahead, but don't call it clean.
Because that most highly reactive part, I'm trying to recall, but we're talking about a half-life of thousands of years for that, I believe.
Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands of years. But for the first century, if something happened around that storage area, those casks, and that got out, that's a serious...
Very serious.
Emergency situation.
Very serious, and we at Citizens Awareness Network have been very concerned about the isthmuses, as they're called, the storage areas where the spent fuel is all over New England. We have an isthmus, which is an independent fuel storage installation, but there's one at Maine Yankee, there's one at Connecticut Yankee. These are former nuclear power plants that are gone.
They're all sitting on waterways because they were using that for cooling. So that one at Vermont Yankee is probably in the floodplain.
It's sitting on the floodplain of the Connecticut River at the Roe, Massachusetts. It's sitting on the Deerfield River and just north of it.
That's the way we're going to move our high-level waste out of Vermont.
Downstream.
But north of Roe in Vermont is the Harriman Reservoir, which is the largest lake, inland lake, totally contained in Vermont, and it's artificial. It's there because there's a dam. And so we're concerned that the state really makes sure that they have a plan in place and are doing the proper maintenance at these locations.
So they've done a very elaborate job of encapsulating that high-level waste. They've got cement, and then they've got stainless steel canister.
Yes.
But the longevity of that doesn't even begin to be part of the bar graph of how long that waste is going to actually be hot enough to kill people.
Right. And the other myth that is being spun around this nuclear renaissance is this idea that, oh, don't worry about the waste. We're just going to recycle it. That is an insult and is absurd.
How technically are they arguing that they could recycle it safely and minimize its radioactive
safely,
impact?
Safely, that's the word.
Too safe to meter. Back in the late 50s.
There you go.
Yeah, it's too safe to meter.
They've hired consultants to come in and help them, and one consultant, I'm sure, got a fat paycheck for saying, you know what, you have to stop using the term reprocessing of the waste and start calling it recycling, which is what they've been doing.
Nice buzzword.
Reprocessing is the fundamental, mechanical, chemical process that's used to separate radionuclides from spent reactor fuel, spent fission reactor fuel. And it was fundamental to the creation of the plutonium bomb, the plutonium-based bomb. And we're dealing with the aftermath of that process in large part at a place called Hanford, Washington.
Know it well.
Where the government has been dawdling and dragging its feet in terms of the multi-billion dollar cleanup that's necessary to deal with the sludge that's left over from the reprocessing.
Yeah, the nasties from the reprocessing is worse than what went in.
Right.
Just get smaller.
Right. And it's sitting in tanks and has been contaminating the Columbia River for decades.
Wow.
And the other one, when they decided that they'd let a private company try reprocessing, was in West Valley, New York. And that is one of many radioactive Superfund sites. The company went bankrupt and left behind a filthy mess that to this day still needs to be cleaned up. It's owned by the taxpayers of the state of New York at this point.
Wow.
So when they talk about, recycling and, it's just,
Do we have any grand figures? I mean, everything we do in our modern middle-class living is leaving some sort of nasty footprint behind if we could learn to live with nature and do that side of it, we could have quality of life without damaging the earth. But we seem a long ways from really getting back to back to Earth, living on Earth properly. So if we accept the middle class existence, at least to some degree, everything has a footprint. And do you have any sense of what the nuclear renaissance has left behind for a footprint? Any estimate of cancer increase or death or anything to kind of put it on a scale with, let's take a really bad one like burning coal for energy.
There are a lot of people comparing nuclear and coal and natural gas and so forth. And I'm not a health professional, and I won't play one on the radio.
Yeah.
But there's no question that the atomic activities have a fatality trail. What it is exactly, it's not anything.
I'm going to expand this beyond. Obviously, we're talking mostly about U.S. nuclear policy here, but there are nuclear reactors all around the world. Do you get a sense in Western Europe, in China, in Russia, whether those governments or other nonprofits are monitoring the effects of nuclear radiation? Or, not that that's part of your job, but I'm just wondering now as we see our current administration backing off on on monitoring and inspections and regulations, whether that's a global phenomenon or fairly unique to our country?
I would say that the Western Europeans, they track it very closely.
Mm-hmm.
Japan, even though they have a schizophrenic relationship.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
They had it all turned on, and they turned it all off, right. And then they had to turn it back on.
They track it very closely.
What the fook? Yeah.
But in 2006, I was invited to an international conference in Ukraine to observe the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl accident, and sat for days with headphones on like these, listening to local experts and just regular everyday Ukrainians talk about the impact of the accident.
Yeah.
And, to hear it today from people promoting the Renaissance, Chernobyl killed four people,
Yeah,
they say
well.
Things like that, which is, again, it's an insult and it's absurd.
Yeah, it was a people long stream of radioactive iodine affecting people a long ways downwind.
I worked with a group that was based in Ireland for years called the Chernobyl Children's Project, and what they were doing was raising money to bring children from Ukraine to medical facilities here in the U.S. And, it's an unending string of sickness
right.
that stems from Chernobyl. I was invited to go to Fukushima, and I said, I'm going to decline.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But, again, there are activists and there are leaders in Japan that can go ahead and do the same thing with the the accident in Fukushima.
Well,
in
they did quite a lot of ongoing work after the Hiroshima Nagasaki.
Yep.
And obviously there were, it was major instant kill for a lot of people, but they've been following people for their entire lives after that. And so they have pretty good numbers that some people make it through even though they got a lot of radiation, but an awful lot
don't make it.
Don't.
So what about the argument that will be brought up by supporters of another renaissance of nuclear that, well, the energy needs of our communities, our states, the United States, are such that let renewable energy, get a foothold, which it clearly has, but we can't really get to, full capacity of the energy needs without having nuclear. How do you respond to that?
Well, number one, the cost of nuclear, including all the government subsidies, has been and will be through the roof. By diverting resources into nuclear, you're taking away from the development not only of other sources of generation, but from other applications of efficiency, which is where we really need to go. When people really press me and say, well, what do
That's
you think?
That's true,
I say what we really need to be doing is looking at the consumption side of this and reducing our consumption as effectively and efficiently as we possibly can. And I'm proud to be a Vermonter and say that Efficiency Vermont, the concept of an efficiency utility, was a fabulous...
very first in the country.
Yes.
Yep.
And the model has been used and applied in other places, not enough at this point.
Right.
But the idea that you take ratepayer dollars and invest it in a way that reduces consumption and reward people for reducing consumption is the way to go.
And I can remember when, when the heat rolling off of incandescent light bulbs actually was a factor in how warm it was in rooms.
Yep.
And now you don't have that, especially in the summertime, which you know, maybe that's not a big factor, but it is interesting how that efficiency turns around and makes living better. It isn't mm-hmm. just, and that's one of the things I'm kind of, I feel is exciting about this terrace solar, porch solar thing, is that you can pay as much attention or as little attention to how much it's saving you. But if you get curious about it and it's your power you're generating, you start thinking about other efficiencies in your house. Just as Todd was saying, you can make a point of running your clothes dryer when the sun's shining instead of doing it at 9 o'clock at night.
Yep.
It's another form of what in the EV world, maybe other people use this term, hyperwatting.
Yeah.
That I want to, you know, use as little energy, but still be able to, you know, get where you're going or to keep the things going in your home that you need to keep going. But there are a lot of things, and I've had back and forth, not recently, about components that have phantom power. They're on all the time.
Yep. Yes.
And I would bet that most households that are connected to the grid in particular are not even aware of the total load that, hey, all the lights are off, everything's down, we're sleeping, how much power is still being used unnecessarily. And that's a big efficiency that could be brought to bear.
I think there are just a few. I know my flat screen TV, when you turn it off, it isn't off. It's drawing, I don't know what, maybe 5 watts. It's not insignificant. And those things do add up. I think one of the things is anyone who is on cable, those cable boxes do a lot more than a flat screen TV in terms of being on idle. And if you shut them off and turn it back on, you can do that, but it takes 10 minutes for it to download all the information to know what channels what and so forth before you can start watching it. So it really doesn't make you want to turn it off. Not unless you put it on a timer and you always watch the evening news and you give it a head start.
Well, I can assure you we'll be watching for Ann Watson's bill.
Yep. Yeah.
And
back to real
and
stuff.
And doing what we can to get people to call their legislators to support it. That's important.
You know, when we were talking with the head of the Norwich Energy Committee about balcony solar a couple weeks ago, she brought up, and actually another guest we had on the show, Bill McKibben, recently also said, you know, get in touch with your legislators. And even if they're not on a committee that necessarily is going to consider this bill initially, they need to be educated by their constituents about certain things that they're just too busy or that's not in their bailiwick or whatever. And if it's kind of on their radar screen before January, early January, when the session starts, the chances of that bill moving along, because you can imagine there will be lobbyists pushing back against this bill big time. And we'll see how that goes. Are you going to be spending any time in Montpelier in January, Chris?
I'm sure I will be, but I have to say I've gotten too comfortable with being able to zoom into the room, as they say.
Well, more energy efficient, too.
It is, yeah. And observe what's going on with the different committees.
But there's something special about actually being there with people. And
right, you get crammed in like this. And
yeah. you have to start treating each other like human beings.
But you do have the opportunity to have chats with legislators and other people in the hall or have a lunch in the cafeteria, be part of the process that way.
So I think going back to the nuclear thing probably being kind of like a red herring, something that's being looked at but never going to really bear fruit, I think that that same thing is actually happening with oil and coal, that electric cars are more efficient and they're the models out there are getting more and more sophisticated and more user friendly. And even though there's a lot of pushback against them with the Trump administration, they're going to eventually totally win the day. They're just so much simpler and more fun to drive unless you really enjoy playing the gears with a manual 5 or 8 on the floor or something, you know.
And ultimately, I've been saying this for decades, what we really are needing is far more efficient mass transportation.
Yeah.
Even in a place like Vermont. Not all parts of Vermont, but many parts of Vermont could benefit from more mass transit and efficient mass transit. So
yeah, I spend a lot of time in Burlington, and I'm amazed at the amount of traffic that is on the interstate between Burlington and Waterbury. That zone in there, Mount Pelier, Burlington, Waterbury, really could use Bud cars and
David Blittersdorf.
Yes,
you know that was something he tried to invest in.
So let me just finish that idea about the finance of it. So it turns out that even if you got the drill baby drill thing turned on with the federal government giving ever so much more subsidy to the fossil fuel industry, even pre-Trump, they just were in the habit of being on the dole. And even if you don't take that money into consideration, wind and especially solar is solar together with battery storage is cheaper, and once you put it up, it goes.
Right, and it doesn't have a fuel cost, which That's is what really drives the fossil fuel and nuclear people crazy.
Yeah, they have to keep digging up more uranium or oil, one or the other. And it gets more and more expensive to dig it up. You go back to T-Bone Pickens or one of the early days when you just drilled a water well and hit the wrong thing and got oil out of the ground and it was easy peasy.
Just to go back to what I talked about earlier about the two plants in Georgia that were actually completed.
Yeah, how are they doing now?
Well, they turned them on about 15 years later than what they had projected. And the cost doubled also. They cost the two units cost $35 billion. Wow. So, you know, I think as we approach these small modular reactors and other nuclear proposals, I think it's important for our public figures, our leaders, to ask the question right off the bat, what's this going to cost?
Right.
And see what answers they get, because the costs will just overwhelm public budgets, but also I think have a lot of utilities saying thanks but no thanks.
Right. That was a factor within Vermont Yankee. I mean, that was not not cheaper too cheap to meter electricity.
And you know, the bottom line that we talked about also with the waste. There's a cost connected to the waste that I've been told by accountants who work for the Department of Energy. This was some time ago, but
They wouldn't talk to you today, probably, Chris.
No,
not those.
But when I asked,
they've all been fired.
Yeah, right. When I asked at a public hearing in Nevada how much it was going to cost to store all the high-level nuclear waste, the accountant for the DOE told me that number is incalculable.
Right, because it's such a long term.
Right, and I said, thank you very much, and that was on the record. So,
right. Incalculable. Wow. This has been a great visit with you, Chris, and filling us in. And I'm glad you started off with, you know, that this probably isn't going to really get much traction. We know, and maybe briefly, we know the governor of Massachusetts, who I believe is a Democrat.
Yes.
Not that party role, as we know, we've for several terms now have had the most popular governor in the United States, a Republican, Phil Scott. But that, you know, it's still important that not to be sleeping at the switch, to stay up with your legislators, stay on top of energy policy in general, not just what's happening with nuclear, but what could happen with solar and wind and hydro. And I really like the fact that you brought up conservation and efficiency there, because I'm tired of hearing from federal officials that, well, the growth of energy, the needs we have for energy are just going up all the time. And I'm thinking, do they always need to go up? Isn't there a way to get to a flat line at some point?
Which is what we've been approaching with the activities of, say, the last 30 years. I also like to just comment on Governor Healey and what's going on in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
In Massachusetts, they passed a law, I believe it was in 1982, that said you can't build a nuclear power plant in the state of Massachusetts without having a statewide referendum approve it. Governor Healey, among other things, she has a massive bill right now with a lot of good things in it. It's a Christmas tree, as it's called.
Yeah.
But one of the things it has buried deep in it is elimination of that requirement for a statewide referendum to approve the construction of a new...
That's why it's important to have people like you looking at the...
Well, I have to tell you that my colleagues in Massachusetts are in the process of building a coalition and directing...
Focusing on that.
And directing people to give the governor... some pressure.
I mean, if you look at what the Trump administration did, they just pulled their big beautiful bill together and gave people what 48 hours or less to see it before they had to vote on it. It was you know, a whole bookshelf full of wish lists.
Yeah.
So
well, that's great. Hey, before I let you go, Chris, we've only got about 7 minutes. You're probably aware of this film. I've seen it a couple of times now, and it does go back. It takes place in Vermont and in Massachusetts, and it's available. We saw it at Solar Fest. We saw it down at the White River Independent Film Festival. It's called Far Out: Life on and After the Commune. Have you seen that?
I have heard of it, but I've not seen it yet. It's on my list of... You know.
But it's a great example of citizen action at a specific commune here in Vermont when a nuclear power plant, actually it was, what was it, a big tower was going to go up there, and they stopped it. And then this group of sort of basically hippies, activists that often came up from New York City, they got together and basically the no nukes movement in the late 70s grew out of the activities of these folks living off the grid on a farm in both Massachusetts and Vermont. So check that one out, and maybe the radio station might be screening that at some time later this year, maybe in conjunction with the law school. We never know.
Yeah.
Great to have you on with us. Look forward to seeing what happens with that bill up in Montpelier here in January. And we're going to get to a couple of items. Henry, you have something in front of you? I've got the Northern Woodlands, which has just put out its autumn edition. We've got about 6 minutes to go. And if you're out in the woods, as I have been the last couple of days, particularly kind of nice to walk around when it was raining in the woods, because that hasn't happened in about 2 months. As far as things that you can look for, American asters, goldenrods, give late blooms of summer, and they feed bees. The bees are still very active. I've seen some butterflies, with the majority of the other flowers having come and gone. These species monopolize pollinators' attention and have a brief window before fertilization and setting seed before killing frost come. Other things that are emphasized in A Walk in the Woods for the last week in September, the broad-winged hawk is in here. The Aishna dragonfly, I've seen quite a bit of that. So just pointing you out, another great information source that's produced in Lyme, New Hampshire, nearby, and it's called Northern Woodlands, a quarterly magazine that's online as well as a print edition. Now I'm going to toss it back to you, Henry.
Yeah, there's some fun things that people are having a chance to laugh about, all the awful stuff that's going on. And I recommend, I'm not going to try to read it, but I just recommend that that you go online and you do Bill McKibben, the stupidest speech in U.S. history.
Yeah, just the other day
in U.N. history, and he really has some fun pointing out just how idiotic Trump's activity at the UN was. His 15-minute window that he, but he goes into, well, he's not, he hasn't, he only took an hour when he had 15 minutes. Castro took, I've forgotten what it was.
A pretty long time.
Four hours and 35 minutes when he had 15 minutes. But he goes through and pokes holes out.
Yeah, and once again, that is available. Bill has actually been putting out more. I thought it was once a week, but it's like two or three times a week. Yeah. And you know, his new book is out. I picked up a copy. I know you've already read it. I'm going to poke through it. It's called "Here Comes the Sun," and yeah, it's good to kind of hard. We had actually had a couple chuckles about nuclear there, going through that, but. Yeah, good thing to check out. Once again, I want to remind folks, if you want to read about, and hopefully something that will be revived, and that is Group Net Meter Solar in Vermont, that is no longer around. And there is a story about and it tells you a lot of statistics about the money that people are going to save from this Randolph-based solar array. You can't get much more local. It's based in Randolph. The people that are going to benefit from it are in that area, and the company that built it is also from Randolph. Boy, can't get much more local than that. Catamount Solar. Yeah, that's in today's Herald front page. Yep.
And I have a friend in Tunbridge who's been up helping me on trying to stop a leak in my earth-bermed house. House roof, which
I remember walking around on that roof a couple decades ago.
Yeah, well, this one's actually just over the entryway, but
okay.
it's still causing some rot problem, and I decided I really had to fix it rather than let it subside over time. It might have gone another 10 or 20 years anyway, but we tore into it, and he said, well, I don't watch late night TV, and I certainly haven't ever watched any of those late night TV, Saturday Night Live and so forth. But he said, you know, I heard all this talk about Colbert coming back on air, and he said, look that up and watch some of his clips, because he also has had a lot of fun with just being outrageous and poking holes and
yeah. Well, you know, it's important.
Being laughable.
You know, and actually this is down at the Smithsonian. Today is being recognized as First Amendment Day, and they're having a couple special programs down there. And I think what we're talking about with these TV humorists and you know, other people that are, you know, just trying to speak up, speak out often with humor, is that we really need to protect our Constitution, the First Amendment. We have a right to dissent from government action without losing your job or being reprimanded or sent out of the country or whatever it is. Yeah. So I want to just squeeze in before we get to the last 10 seconds, because we still have a little bit over a minute, the folks that keep this type of programming on the air for 12 and a half years, and they include the Yes We Can Collective, Wit and Grit, a restaurant in Randolph, as a matter of fact, Solar Fest, First Branch Coffee Company, Solaflect Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, and the Upper Pass Beer Company. And just to go back to Solarfest, they're going to be having a meeting, Henry, and I'm inviting you on, well, they might change it because they're having it on October 13th, which is Indigenous Peoples Day. Mm. A lot of people honoring that. But we're going to be working on what the plans for Solarfest are. Right now, they are powering a major biking event over at Killington with their solar trailers. So good for them. And just to remind folks that you can catch the rebroadcast of this show, the replay of the show, on our website starting tomorrow morning at WFVR.org. Chris, once again, thanks for joining us. Henry, as always, great to see you in the studio.
And next week we will have a energy guru from the Vermont Electric Co-op.
All right, looking forward to that. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, WFVR LP, South Royalton.